I stopped to visit him a few years ago, I found that tourists were pouring in to see his rattlesnake farm at the rate of 20,000 a year. His business was thriving. I saw poison from the fangs of his rattlers being shipped to laboratories to make anti-venom toxin. I saw rattlesnake skins being sold at fancy prices to make women's shoes and handbags. I saw canned rattlesnake meat being shipped to customers all over the world. I bought a picture postcard of the place and mailed it at the local post office of the village, which had been rechristened Rattlesnake, Florida, in honor of a man who had turned a poison lemon into a sweet lemonade. As I've traveled up and down and back and forth across this nation time after time, it has been my privilege to meet dozens of men and women who have demonstrated their power to turn a minus into a plus. The late William Bolitho, author of 12 Against the Gods, put it like this: "The most important thing in life is not to capitalize on your gains. Any fool can do that. The really important thing is to profit from your losses. That requires intelligence, and it makes the difference between a man of sense and a fool." Bolitho uttered those words after he had lost a leg in a railway accident. But I know a man who lost both legs and turned his minus into a plus. His name is Ben Fortson. I met him in a hotel elevator in Atlanta, Georgia. As I stepped into the elevator, I noticed this cheerful-looking man who had both legs missing sitting in a wheelchair in a corner of the elevator. When the elevator stopped at his floor, he asked me pleasantly if I would step to one corner so he could manage his chair better. "So sorry," he said, "to inconvenience you," and a deep, heartwarming smile lighted his face as he said it. When I left the elevator and went to my room, I could think of nothing but this cheerful cripple, so I hunted him up and asked him to tell me his story. "It happened in 1929," he told me with a smile. "I'd gone out to cut a load of hickory poles to stake the beans in my garden. I had loaded the poles onto my Ford and started back home. Suddenly, one pole slipped under the car and jammed the steering apparatus at the very moment I was making a sharp turn. The car shot over an embankment and hurled me against a tree. My spine was hurt. My legs were paralyzed. I was 24 when that happened, and I've never taken a step since." 24 years old and sentenced to a wheelchair for the rest of his life. I asked him how he managed to take it so courageously, and he said, "I didn't." He said he raged and rebelled. He fumed about his fate. But as the years dragged on, he found that his rebellion wasn't getting him anything except bitterness. "I finally realized," he said, "that other people were kind and courteous to me, so the least I could do was be kind and courteous to them." I asked if he still felt, after all these years, that his accident had been a terrible misfortune, and he promptly said no. He said, "I am almost glad now that it happened." He told me that after he got over the shock and resentment, he began to live in a different world. He began to read and developed a love for good literature. In 14 years, he said, he had read at least 1,400 books, and those books had opened up new horizons for him and made his life richer than he had ever thought possible. He began to listen to good music, and he's now thrilled by great symphonies that would have bored him before. But the biggest change was that he had time to think. "For the first time in my life," he said, "I was able to look at the world and get a real sense of values. I began to realize that most of the things I'd been striving for before weren't worthwhile at all." As a result of his reading, he became interested in politics, studied public questions, made speeches from his wheelchair. He got to know people, and people got to know him, and still in his wheelchair, he got to be Secretary of State for the state of Georgia. While conducting adult education classes in New York City, I've discovered that one of the major regrets of many adults is that they never went to college. They seem to think that not having a college education is a great handicap. I know that this isn't necessarily true because I've known thousands of successful men who never went beyond high school. So I often tell these students the story of a man I knew who had never finished even grade school. He was brought up in blighting poverty. When his father died, his father's friends had to chip in to pay for the coffin in which he was buried. After his father's death, his mother worked in an umbrella factory 10 hours a day and then brought piecework home and worked until 11 o'clock at night. The boy, brought up in these circumstances, went in for amateur dramatics, put on by a club in his church. He got such a thrill out of acting that he decided to take up public speaking, and this led him into politics. By the time he reached 30, he was elected to the New York State Legislature. But he was woefully unprepared for such a responsibility. In fact, he told me that, frankly, he didn't know what it was all about. He studied the long, complicated bills that he was supposed to vote on, but as far as he was concerned, those bills might as well have been written in the language of the Choctaw Indians. He was worried and bewildered when he was made a member of the Committee on Forests before he'd ever set foot in a forest. He was worried and bewildered when he was made a member of the State Banking Commission before he had ever had a bank account. He himself told me that he was so discouraged that he would have resigned from the legislature if he hadn't been ashamed to admit defeat to his mother. In despair, he decided to study 16 hours a day and turn his lemon of ignorance into a lemonade of knowledge. By doing that, he transformed himself from a local politician into a national figure and made himself so outstanding that the New York Times called him the best-loved citizen of New York. I'm talking about Al Smith. 10 years after Al Smith set out on his program of political self-education, he was the greatest living authority on the government of New York State. He was elected governor of New York for 4 terms, at that time a record never attained by any other man. In 1928, he was the Democratic candidate for president. 6 great universities, including Columbia and Harvard, conferred honorary degrees upon this man who had never gone beyond grade school. Al Smith himself told me that none of these things would ever have come to pass if he hadn't worked hard 16 hours a day to turn his minus into a plus. Nietzsche's formula for the superior man was not only to bear up under necessity, but to live it. The more I've studied the careers of men of achievement, the more deeply I've been convinced that surprisingly large numbers of them succeeded because they started out with handicaps that spurred them on to greater endeavor and greater rewards. As William James said, our very infirmities help us unexpectedly. Yes, it's highly probable that Milton wrote better poetry because he was blind, and that Beethoven composed better music because he was deaf. Helen Keller's brilliant career was inspired and made possible because of her blindness and deafness. If Tchaikovsky had not been frustrated and driven almost to suicide by his tragic marriage, if his own life had not been pathetic, he probably would never have been able to compose his immortal Symphonie Pathétique. If Dostoevsky and Tolstoy had not led tortured lives, they would probably never have been able to write their immortal novels. If I had not been so great an invalid, wrote the man who changed the scientific concept of life on Earth, if I had not been so great an invalid, I should not have done so much work as I have accomplished. And that was Charles Darwin's confession that his infirmities had helped him unexpectedly. The same day that Darwin was born in England, another baby was born in a log cabin in the forests of Kentucky. He, too, was helped by his infirmities. His name was Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln. If he had been reared in an aristocratic family and had had a law degree from Harvard and a happy married life, he would probably never have found in the depths of his heart the haunting words that he immortalized at Gettysburg, nor the sacred poem that he spoke at his second inauguration, the most beautiful and noble phrases ever uttered by a ruler of men, with malice toward none, with charity for all. Harry Emerson Fosdick says in his book, The Power to See It Through, there is a Scandinavian saying which some of us might well take as a rallying cry for our lives. The North Wind made the Vikings. Wherever did we get the idea that secure and pleasant living, the absence of difficulty and the comfort of ease, ever of themselves made people either good or happy? Upon the contrary, people who pity themselves go on pitying themselves even when they are laid softly on a cushion. But always in history, character and happiness have come to people in all sorts of circumstances, good, bad, and indifferent, when they shouldered their personal responsibility. So repeatedly, the North Wind has made the Vikings. Suppose we're so discouraged that we feel there's no hope of our ever being able to turn our lemons into lemonade. Then here are two reasons why we ought to try, anyway. Two reasons why we have everything to gain and nothing to lose. Reason one, we may succeed. Reason two, even if we don't succeed, the mere attempt to turn our minus into a plus will cause us to look forward instead of backward. It will replace negative thoughts with positive thoughts. It will release creative energy and spur us to get so busy that we won't have either the time or the inclination to mourn over what is past and forever gone. Once when Ole Bull, the world-famous violinist, was giving a concert in Paris, the A string on his violin suddenly snapped. But Ole Bull simply finished the melody on three strings. "That is life," says Harry Emerson Fosdick, "to have your A string snap and finish on three strings." That is not only life, it is more than life, it is life triumphant. If I had the power to do so, I would have these words of William Bolitho carved in eternal bronze and hung in every schoolhouse in the land. The most important thing in life is not to capitalize on your gains. Any fool can do that. The really important thing is to profit from your losses. That requires intelligence, and it makes the difference between a man of sense and a fool. So to cultivate a mental attitude that will bring us peace and happiness, let's do something about Rule 6. When fate hands us a lemon, let's try to make a lemonade. Chapter 18. How to Cure Depression in 14 Days. When I started writing this book, I offered a $200 prize for the most helpful and inspiring true story on how I conquered worry. The three judges for this contest were Eddie Rickenbacker, President, Eastern Airlines, Dr. Stuart W. McClelland, President, Lincoln Memorial University, H.B. Kaltenborn, radio news analyst. However, we received two stories so superb that the judges found it impossible to choose between them. So we divided the prize. Here's one of the stories that tied for first prize. The story of C.R. Burton, who worked for Whizzer Motor Sales of Springfield, Missouri. "I lost my mother when I was 9 years old and my father when I was 12," Mr. Burton wrote me. "My father was killed, but my mother simply walked out of the house one day 19 years ago, and I've never seen her since. Neither have I ever seen my two little sisters that she took with her. She never even wrote me a letter until after she'd been gone 7 years. My father was killed in an accident 3 years after Mother left. He and a partner had bought a cafe in a small Missouri town, and while Father was away on a business trip, his partner sold the cafe for cash and skipped out. A friend wired Father to hurry back home, and in his hurry, Father was killed in a car accident at Salinas, Kansas. Two of my father's sisters, who were poor and old and sick, took three of the children into their homes, and nobody wanted me and my little brother. We were left at the mercy of the town. We were haunted by the fear of being called orphans and treated as orphans. Our fears soon materialized, too. I lived for a little while with a poor family in town, but times were hard, and the head of the family lost his job, so they couldn't afford to feed me any longer. Then Mr. and Mrs. Lofton took me to live with them on their farm 11 miles from town. Mr. Lofton was 70 years old and sick in bed with shingles. He told me I could stay there as long as I didn't lie, didn't steal, and did as I was told. Those three orders became my Bible. I lived by them strictly. I started to school, but the first week found me at home bawling like a baby. The other children picked on me and poked fun at my big nose and said I was dumb and called me an orphan brat. I was hurt so badly that I wanted to fight them, but Mr. Lofton, the farmer who'd taken me in, said to me, 'Always remember that it takes a bigger man to walk away from a fight than it does to stay and fight.' I didn't fight until one day a kid picked up some chicken manure from the schoolhouse yard and threw it in my face. I beat the hell out of him and made a couple of friends. They said he had it coming to him. I was proud of a new cap that Mrs. Lofton had bought me. One day one of the big girls jerked it off my head and filled it with water, ruined it. She said she filled it with water so the water would wet my thick skull and keep my popcorn brains from popping. I never cried at school, but I used to bawl it out at home. Then one day Mrs. Lofton gave me some advice that did away with all troubles and worries and turned my enemies into friends. She said, "Ralph, they won't tease you and call you an orphan brat any more if you'll get interested in them and see how much you can do for them." I took her advice. I studied hard, and though I soon headed the class, I was never envied because I went out of my way to help them. I helped several of the boys write their themes and essays. I wrote complete debates for some of the boys. One lad was ashamed to let his folks know that I was helping him, so he used to tell his mother he was going possum hunting. And he'd come up to Mr. Lofton's and tie his dogs up in the barn while I helped him with his lessons. I wrote book reviews for one lad, and I spent several evenings helping one of the girls on her math. Death struck our neighborhood. Two elderly farmers died, and one woman was deserted by her husband. I was the only male in four families. I helped these widows for 2 years. On my way to and from school, I stopped at their farms, cut wood for them, milked their cows, and fed and watered their stock. I was now blessed instead of cursed. I was accepted as a friend by everyone. They showed me their real feelings when I returned home from the Navy. More than 200 farmers came to see me the first day I was home. Some of them drove as far as 80 miles, and their concern for me was really sincere. Because I've been busy and happy trying to help other people, I have few worries, and I haven't been called an orphan brat now for 13 years. Hooray for C.R. Burton. He knows how to win friends, and he also knows how to conquer worry and enjoy life. So did the late Dr. Frank Loop of Seattle, Washington. He was an invalid for 23 years, arthritis. Yet Stuart Whithouse of the Seattle Star wrote me saying, "I interviewed Dr. Loop many times, and I have never known a man more unselfish or a man who got more out of life." How did this bedridden invalid get so much out of life? I'll give you two guesses. Did he do it by complaining and criticizing? No. By wallowing in self-pity and demanding that he be the center of attention and everyone cater to him? No. Still wrong. He did it by adopting as his slogan the motto of the Prince of Wales, "Ich dien, I serve." He accumulated the names and addresses of other invalids and cheered both them and himself by writing happy, encouraging letters. In fact, he organized a letter-writing club for invalids and got them writing letters to one another. Finally, he formed a national organization called the Shut-In Society. As he lay in bed, he wrote an average of 1,400 letters a year and brought joy to thousands of invalids by getting radios and books for shut-ins. What was the chief difference between Dr. Loop and a lot of other people? Just this. Dr. Loop had the inner glow of a man with a purpose, a mission. He had the joy of knowing that he was being used by an idea far nobler and more significant than himself, instead of being, as Shaw put it, a self-centered little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world would not devote itself to making him happy. Here's the most astonishing statement that I ever read from the pen of a great psychiatrist. This statement was made by Alfred Adler. He used to say to his melancholia patients, "You can be cured in 14 days if you follow this prescription. Try to think every day how you can please someone." That statement sounds so incredible that I feel I ought to try to explain it by quoting a couple of pages from Dr. Adler's splendid book, What Life Should Mean to You. Melancholia is like a long-continued rage and reproach against others. Though for the purpose of gaining care, sympathy, and support, the patient seems only to be dejected about his own guilt. A melancholiac's first memory is generally something like this. "I can remember I wanted to lie on the couch, but my brother was lying there. I cried so much that he had to leave." Melancholiacs are often inclined to revenge themselves by committing suicide, and the doctor's first care is to avoid giving them an excuse for suicide. I myself try to relieve the whole tension by proposing to them as the first rule of treatment, never do anything you don't like. This seems to be very modest, but I believe that it goes right to the root of the whole trouble. If a melancholiac is able to do anything he wants, whom can he accuse? What has he got to revenge himself for? If you want to go to the theater, I tell him, or go on a holiday, do it. If you find on the way that you don't want to, stop it. It's the best situation anyone could be in. It gives a satisfaction to his striving for superiority. He is like God and can do what he pleases. On the other hand, it does not fit very easily into his style of life. He wants to dominate and accuse others, and if they agree with him, there is no way of dominating them. This rule is a great relief, and I have never had a suicide among my patients. Generally, the patient replies, "But there is nothing I like doing. I have prepared for this answer because I have heard it so often." "Then refrain from doing anything you dislike," I say. Sometimes, however, he will reply, "I should like to stay in bed all day." I know that if I allow it, he will no longer want to do it. I know that if I hinder him, he will start a war. I always agree. This is one rule. Another attacks their style of life still more directly. I tell them, "You can be cured in 14 days if you follow this prescription. Try to think every day how you can please someone." See what this means to them. They are occupied with the thought, "How can I worry someone?" Their answers are very interesting. Some say, "Oh, this will be very easy for me. I have done it all my life." They have never done it. I ask them to think it over. They do not think it over. I tell them, "You can make use of all the time you spend when you are unable to go to sleep by thinking how you can please someone, and it will be a big step forward in your health." When I see them the next day, I ask them, "Did you think over what I suggested?" They answer, "Last night I went to sleep as soon as I got into bed." All this must be done, of course, in a modest, friendly manner, without a hint of superiority. Others will answer, "I could never do it. I was so worried." I tell them, "Don't stop worrying, but at the same time you can think now and then of others." I want to direct their interest always toward their fellows. Many say, "Why should I please others?" "Others do not try to please me. You must think of your health," I answer. "The others will suffer later on." It's extremely rare that I have found a patient who said, "I have thought over what you suggested. All my efforts are devoted toward increasing the social interest of the patient." I know that the real reason for his malady is his lack of cooperation, and I want him to see it too. As soon as he can connect himself with his fellow men on an equal and cooperative footing, he is cured. The most important task imposed by religion has always been, "Love thy neighbor." It is the individual who is not interested in his fellow man who has the greatest difficulties in life and provides the greatest injury to others. It is from among such individuals that all human failures spring. All that we demand of a human being, and the highest praise we can give him, is that he should be a good fellow worker, a friend to all other men, and a true partner in love and marriage. Dr. Adler urges us to do a good deed every day. And what is a good deed? A good deed, said the Prophet Muhammad, is one that brings a smile of joy to the face of another. Why will doing a good deed every day produce such astounding effects on the doer? Because trying to please others will cause us to stop thinking of ourselves, the very thing that produces worry and fear and melancholia. Mrs. William T. Moon, who operated the Moon Secretarial School in New York, didn't have to spend 2 weeks thinking how she could please someone in order to banish her melancholy. She went Alfred Adler one better. No, she did Adler 13 better. She banished her melancholy not in 14 days, but in one day, by thinking how she could please a couple of orphans. It happened like this. "In December, 5 years ago," said Mrs. Moon, "I was engulfed in the feeling of sorrow and self-pity. After several years of happy married life, I had lost my husband. As the Christmas holidays approached, my sadness deepened. I'd never spent a Christmas alone in all my life, and I dreaded to see this Christmas come. Friends had invited me to spend Christmas with them, but I did not feel up to any gaiety. I knew I would be a wet blanket at any party, so I refused their kind invitations. As Christmas Eve approached, I was more and more overwhelmed with self-pity. True, I should have been thankful for many things, as all of us have many things for which to be thankful. The day before Christmas, I left my office at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and started walking aimlessly up Fifth Avenue, hoping that I might banish my self-pity and melancholy. The avenue was jammed with gay and happy crowds, scenes that brought back memories of happy years that were gone. I just couldn't bear the thought of going home to a lonely, empty apartment. I was bewildered. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't keep the tears back. After walking aimlessly for an hour or so, I found myself in front of a bus terminal. I remembered that my husband and I had often boarded an unknown bus for adventure, so I boarded the first bus I found at the station. After crossing the Hudson River and riding for some time, I heard the bus conductor say, "Last stop, lady." I got off. I didn't even know the name of the town. It was a quiet, peaceful little place. While waiting for the next bus home, I started walking up a residential street. As I passed a church, I heard the beautiful strains of Silent Night. I went in. The church was empty, except for the organist. I sat down, unnoticed, in one of the pews. The lights from the gaily decorated Christmas tree made the decoration seem like myriads of stars dancing in the moonbeams. The long-drawn cadences of the music and the fact that I had forgotten to eat since morning made me drowsy. I was weary and heavy-laden, so I drifted off to sleep. When I awoke, I didn't know where I was. I was terrified. I saw in front of me two small children who had apparently come in to see the Christmas tree. One, a little girl, was pointing at me, saying, "I wonder if Santa Claus brought her." These children were also frightened when I awoke. I told them that I wouldn't hurt them. They were poorly dressed. I asked them where their mother and daddy were. "We ain't got no mother and daddy," they said. Here were two little orphans, much worse off than I had ever been. They made me feel ashamed of my sorrow and self-pity. I showed them the Christmas tree, and then took them to a drugstore, and we had some refreshments, and I bought them some candy and a few presents. My loneliness vanished as if by magic. These two orphans gave me the only real happiness and self-forgetfulness that I had had in months. As I chatted with them, I realized how lucky I had been. I thanked God that all my Christmases as a child had been bright with parental love and tenderness. Those two little orphans did far more for me than I did for them. That experience showed me again the necessity of making other people happy in order to be happy ourselves. I found that happiness is contagious. By giving, we receive. By helping someone and giving out love, I had conquered worry and sorrow and self-pity and felt like a new person. And I was a new person, not only then, but in the years that followed. I could fill a book with stories of people who forgot themselves into health and happiness. For example, let's take the case of Margaret Taylor Yates, one of the most popular women in the United States Navy. Mrs. Yates is a writer of novels, but none of her mystery stories is half so interesting as the true story of what happened to her that fateful morning when the Japanese struck our fleet at Pearl Harbor. Mrs. Yates had been an invalid for more than a year, a bad heart. She spent 22 out of every 24 hours in bed. The longest journey that she undertook was a walk into the garden to take a sunbath. Even then, she had to lean on the maid's arm as she walked. She herself told me that in those days she expected to be an invalid for the rest of her life. "I would never have really lived again," she told me, "if the Japanese had not struck Pearl Harbor and jarred me out of my complacency." When this happened, Mrs. Yates said, as she told her story, "everything was chaos and confusion. One bomb struck so near my home the concussion threw me out of bed. Army trucks rushed out to Hickam Field, Schofield Barracks, and Kaneohe Bay Air Station to bring Army and Navy wives and children to the public schools. There, the Red Cross telephoned those who had extra rooms to take them in. The Red Cross workers knew that I had a telephone beside my bed, so they asked me to be a clearinghouse of information. So I kept track of where Army and Navy wives and children were being housed, and all Navy and Army men were instructed by the Red Cross to telephone me to find out where their families were. I soon discovered that my husband, Commander Robert Raleigh Yates, was safe. I tried to cheer up the wives who did not know whether their husbands had been killed. I tried to give consolation to the widows whose husbands had been killed, and there were many. 2,117 officers and enlisted men in the Navy and Marine Corps were killed, and 960 were reported missing. At first, I answered these phone calls while lying in bed. Then I answered them sitting up in bed. Finally, I got so busy, so excited, that I forgot all about my weakness and got out of bed and sat by a table. By helping others who were much worse off than I was, I forgot all about myself, and I have